In the Sauce is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan, plant-based oat milk originally from Sweden that's now making their oat milk on this side of the Atlantic. For more information, go to oatly.com. That's OATLY.com.
This week on Meat and Three, it's our season four finale, and we're sharing some of our greatest kitchen joys.
Maybe most people consider making it too much work or too messy, but this is the food that's worth the work and worth the wait.
You always know where the thing is because you put it away the right way the first time.
You just sort of stand there and, you know, with your hand on your hip and one leg outstretched, glass of wine in your hand, staring into the refrigerator going, okay, speak to me.
Oh yeah, what are you doing with the celery tonight?
I'm making a simple syrup for a gin cocktail with the celery. And I also found a recipe for a celery soup that's going to use up the celery and the potatoes and some of that dill that we still have hanging out in there.
Tune in and be inspired to find the joy in your kitchen. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat in 3 wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Aaron Patinkin, co-founder and CEO of Ovenly, one of New York's top-rated bakeries. Ovenly has been named one of the best bakeries in New York City by Time Out New York, The Village Voice, and about a zillion other food blogs and media sources. Ovenly baked goods have won the praise of the New York Times, Food 52, The Wall Street Journal, Eater, Serious Eats, Savour, and many others. Aaron is a force and an incredible resource for new founders. Generous and candid, she's on a mission not just to run her company better than the standard, but also to help founders with less access to capital build their dreams. Her writing has been featured in Lucky Peach and Vice. She's been recognized as one of New York's, I love this, most badass women. We're going to talk about that. In food, in New York City by Zagat, and as quote-unquote one to watch by Condé Nast. And she's executive producer and co-host of Start to Sale on Vox. Aaron, I think you know how excited I am to have you here. I feel like we have a lot of the same goals in life, and I've been wanting to have this conversation for a long time. So welcome, and yay.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so excited to be here.
You are our first guest in our, I guess this is our third season, and I feel like from season one, I've just been wanting to talk, and actually it's good that it took this long because we were going through fundraising, and I don't even know if I would have been able to have as like rich of a conversation earlier on. Mm-hmm. So this is very good timing. Very psyched that you're here.
Yeah.
But before we get into all the juicy stuff, I know you grew up in Chicago. Tell me a little bit about yourself as a kid. Were you entrepreneurial? Were you into cookies? What was your sort of vibe?
My dream was to be a cast member of Saturday Night Live when I was a child, and I used to wash grapes and give my Emmy Awards-winning speech, and I remember standing on a stool and doing that. I used to have a recurring dream that Steve Martin was my best friend.
Aww.
So, but I, you know, oddly enough, I remember doing that specifically while I was helping my mom in the kitchen. I would, you know, stand at the sink washing things, giving my Emmy Award-winning speech.
I would do cooking lessons when I was washing things in the sink.
Yeah.
Yeah. So were you like, just so I can picture you, were you a physical comedy kind of kid? Were you like the kind of, like, were you, did you use your body in a funny way, or were you like dry humor?
So I am a trained actor. I studied acting from 7 to 26. I worked in a theater company in Chicago.
Right.
I have a BFA in actually directing, and I did improv for 8 years. But I knew, you know, but that was a really childhood love, and by the time I got to college, I kind of knew that I didn't want to be a performer, but I loved it so much that I didn't know what I wanted to do. So my junior year of college, I actually switched to a directing specialist from acting specialist, which you could do at my university. And that actually, I think, you know, I've taken a long time kind of digesting who I am. Yeah. And I think all that theater and improv and directing is exactly why I can be a leader and an entrepreneur. Yep. At some point in time, I'm going to think about this enough to put pen to paper. But yeah. So I grew up in Chicago. I, you know, wanted to be a professional actor. That's always thought I, what I thought I was going to do.
Have you done your Myers-Briggs? Do you
I don't think so.
Are you like an ENF?
No idea. Yeah. I mean, I know Myers-Briggs, but I've never done it.
I think it'd be fun for you to do it and find out.
I will do it later.
All right.
So
or we could just like stop the podcast and you could continue.
Or I could take a nap. So yeah, so I really was informed by that experience. And I think that's some people who are not artists, what they don't realize about artists is I think there's this really incorrect trope about artists being lazy, but artists are the most hardworking people I've ever met. Yep. You know, I always was going to school, going to theater classes, performing, you know, in high school, I would come home at 9 or 10 at night. In college, I would go to class and then perform or direct or whatever it was I was doing. And so I think I really was informed by that experience and it made me just a workhorse. Like I was used to always working all the time.
And my guess is also, you know, the creative people I know in my life are some of the most like self-critical people I know, but they're also so used to rejection kind of constantly coming at them that they also have to flip that into the most self-motivated people.
I actually tell entrepreneurs today, I'm like, if you want to do yourself a favor, take an improv class because you have to learn to fail and you have to learn to take criticism.
Yeah.
I think having had that experience, I just, you know, as a performer or as an artist, you're just ripped apart every single day by whoever's training you.
Yeah.
That's part of the process to become better.
Yeah.
And so I never really felt really, hurt by criticism. And even in, you know, videos that we've done, you know, people will comment. I just don't read that stuff. I don't, it took me to a place that maybe a more advanced entrepreneur would get to right at the start.
Yeah. That's admirable. I mean, I remember my first no of each thing, the first store that said no, the first people that didn't like it, the first, you know, investor that was like, not for me.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, I got into bed with each one and did that whole sort of, what am I doing? I'm not meant for this. I'm not a businessy person. I'm going to steer my team into like a iceberg, you know, blah, blah, blah. Who do I think I am? That whole thing.
Well, that's a little imposter syndrome in there too, which I think I suffered from for a long time.
Yeah.
Too,
I mean, to me that like the two get very conflated. Yeah. I just get sad.
Yeah.
But I will say that I've gotten much better.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, if you don't get over that you cannot move forward.
No.
And it also helps. I also thought that training helped because everyone is going to tell you what your business should be for the rest of time, from the cab driver to your mentor. Like everyone wants to tell you what your business should be.
Yep.
And I think that training as an artist really helped me sort of steer through all the noise and those cacophony of voices.
Right.
Because, you know, the truth of the matter is at some point, even as an artist, you have to decide, no, I made this choice and I still think it's right and I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And it just helps you. I really think that training helped me be a risk taker. And it's something that I've noticed about myself as I have gotten older is that a lot of my friends are pretty rigid and they get really worried about change. They get worried about job changes or, you know, typical day-to-day life things. And and I have to say, I've seen a lot of friends not make decisions because they're so scared of the other side. Yeah. I'm the opposite, to the point that I think I sometimes am too quick to turn and judge and make decisions where, but that change doesn't freak me out at all. And no doesn't freak me out. I think that the thing that, you know, as a starting entrepreneur, that was more difficult for me was the, you know, I don't know how to put it in a delicate way, but just
you don't have to.
what assholes people would be. Yeah. You know, I was used to criticism. I you know, I was in the arts, so I dealt with a lot of egos.
Yeah.
But just this idea of people who you didn't know just being such jerks to you for no reason.
Do you think that has to do with the money?
Well, no, not just that. Or? Like, you know, vendors, you know, yeah. I mean, I mean, people you'd, you know, when Agatha and I were starting Ovenly, I remember we met another bakery owner and he was introduced to us to provide us with advice. And so we sat down, we had a meeting with him and he owned a bakery. I don't know if it exists anymore. And he was like, let me tell you, just don't even start it. You know, it's just like, why would you squash like 220 something's dreams when they already have this company and they're setting it out?
Yeah.
You know, but I have to say those experiences also inform me. So when people tell me ideas, like even if I don't like the idea in my head, I'll say, you know what, this is your dream.
Yeah.
Like, here's how I would go about it. And just be aware of the risks.
Maybe don't quit your day job just yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But did you go into acting professionally after college?
No, I actually, by the time I was a senior, I knew I did not want to do that.
Right.
So my senior year of college, I started working for a local school system as sort of the teacher putting together after school programming in theater.
Right.
And then I liked that. And I decided, and I have, you know, I went to a Jesuit high school. And so this idea of social justice and working towards something that was based on a mission always was really ingrained into me, even though I was not brought up religiously at all, Catholic or Jewish. And, that was something that really always appealed to me, which is interesting now because when I was in my early 20s, I always knew that I wanted to work for something that was more mission-based.
Right.
But, you know, that was 2001. It's very different today. There were not a lot of options if you were a young person who wanted to go work for a mission-focused
It was for like profit. Teach for America. Oh, yeah. For profit. That wasn't even
this idea of social entrepreneurship was not as large as it is now. And so I always thought, I had to go work for a nonprofit. Right.
So if I'm, by the way, I felt that way in 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, when I opened Havens, the end goal was really like sustainability, right? And, you know,
I remember going there. You were the first person to be totally paperless. I was like, I remember going in and signing iPads, and that was way before anyone else was doing that.
I mean, it was, but my kids, I mean, I've probably told this story before, my kids were sort of flummoxed by like, well, if that's the goal, then why isn't it a nonprofit?
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, I don't know. That's a good question. To me, it was just like, I don't want to have like a fundraiser every year. So I might as well just try to make enough money to keep it going, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but that was much later. So I think the, you know, the social entrepreneurship thing and the sort of emphasis on being able to do really good through doing well, maybe a little lip service-y, but definitely much, I mean, in 2001 for sure.
Yeah.
Not a thing.
That was not a thing. So I ended up working for a theater company for three years and I learned a lot of
in
good
Chicago?
Things and a lot of bad things. Yeah. In Chicago, it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And in the meantime, I got a master's degree in arts management with a focus on arts and youth and community development. So I had this degree that was like half social justice oriented and half, you know, accounting and general basic business stuff.
Right.
But I always thought that I was going to be in this nonprofit industry. And while I was in my 20s living in Chicago, I don't think I knew the word entrepreneur.
No.
I remember starting Ovenly and having, you know, I am a person who I get in trouble for how many ideas and opinions that I have. Like people get upset with me. Sometimes I hear like, you have so many opinions and ideas all the time. It's frustrating, you know? And I, in my 20s, was the same way. And so I'm always a person who has 70 zillion things going on. So while I was working at the theater company, I had 8 million jobs because I made, who knows what minimum wage was in 2001. I don't remember. I just remember I made no money. So I would be waiting tables and I was hustling, I was nannying, I was babysitting, I was doing all the stuff in my early 20s. And then the other thing I got really into was metalsmithing. So I started really studying metalsmithing, and then I started a little metalsmithing and jewelry company, and I was selling, I would launch my own trunk shows, I would go sell at Renegade Craft, you know, I sold to a couple little boutiques.
Right.
And so I was sort of had that entrepreneurial spirit. And then I had a boyfriend at the time. I was managing the business side of his business. Uh-huh. He was an artist turned custom carpenter.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't know that I was a business person, but I was doing all this business stuff on the side. I made, you know, I made a business plan to start. I was called the Minuet Fund. I decided I was going to start a youth fund with this musician that I knew. And right. then I didn't do that. And then I created a business plan for a yeah. food co-op. But everything was nonprofit.
Because, yep.
again, I thought right. that, like, in order to be
yep.
mission-based, I had right. to have a nonprofit. So right. none of that really worked out. And by the way, I was also cooking. Like, I love to cook. Yeah. So I was cooking. I started a blog because that's what you did in the early aughts.
Right.
And working in these nonprofits. And I ultimately was the director of a gallery and art center outside of Chicago. And I was completely jaded on everything. And mm-hmm. I also, I mean, I did a million things again. I taught for the Chicago Children's Museum as their artist in residence.
I'm
and
just
I
was picturing you like school. Running around.
I did. I worked literally. 7 days a yeah. week to make like 30 grand a yeah. year. It was bananas. But one of the jobs that I did, I would go out, you know, to different Chicago public schools and teach creative workshops to CPS students. And by the time I decided to leave Chicago, I was so jaded yeah. on the nonprofit industry.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other podcast. Yep. But I really was very off put by the yearly funding cycle.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of things happen where, like, a, you know, a nonprofit organization would get a grant, and the grant mm-hmm. would be a 3-year grant. And they knew after year one that yep. the thing didn't work. But you know what? They needed the administrative right. fees that are so.
Yeah.
And the way yeah. nonprofit boards work, mm-hmm. I didn't like. So I felt very, very jaded. And I moved to New York and I took a job thinking, like, I'm going to keep this job for a year. And then I'm going to, this whole, that year, I'm going to network and I'm going to get into the food industry as a career.
Okay.
I don't want to wait tables anymore.
Right.
I don't want to bartend.
Yep.
I want to have a job in the food industry. And New York was the place yep. at that time in Absolutely. 2007 to do that.
Yep.
And then I moved here, and 2 months later, crash, recession.
Recession. Oh,
so
yeah.
It was, so that was, that dream of finding another job was completely quashed right away.
Right.
But interestingly, I worked for the National Council of Jewish Women for 3.5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I learned so much there. And it was, I actually liked, you know, I, in the end, was bored with my job
right.
and was killed by the boredom because every year was the same. But yeah. I had an amazing manager who I loved, who I still am to speak to.
Right.
And it's really where I learned to be managed yeah. properly, because in the art, I just kept getting pushed into management positions when I was yeah. like 22, 23, yeah. 24 years old. I had zero
there was
skills.
No system. There was, right.
No one was training me to right. be a manager, and people would be like, go manage those people.
I know.
I was like, it I don't know what I'm doing.
I didn't know. I mean, how would you know? But I didn't know for like the first couple of years that, you know, I thought if you're a nice enough person, then you could be a good enough manager, right?
No,
you know, don't make someone feel like a yeah. piece of garbage. Try to give them fairly clear.
I thought that too. That doesn't work.
It doesn't yeah. work at all.
And you know what? People did that to me. And then I ended up doing that to people yeah. as well. The first few years of Ovenly. And we learned the hard way that
yeah.
just because someone's good at their job doesn't mean they'll be a good manager.
It's actually, I think it's called the Peter principle. And I think it's actually the inverse. I think that's what's so fucked up about the whole thing is
yeah.
that you become... You stop doing what you're actually good at, and you're put in charge of people
right.
who do it, even though you shouldn't be, you know?
I know a lot of people make fun of this book, but there's a book called Radical Candor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things the author talks about is you have your rock stars and your superstars.
Right.
And the superstars are the ones that you have to create a pathway for them to move up with the obvious notion that they're probably going to leave the organization one day because
right.
they're such superstars.
Yep.
And the rock stars are the ones who are rocks. They are good at their jobs.
Yep.
Those people are so valuable.
Yeah.
And you have to learn ways to reward them
yep.
in their positions. Like
yep.
we have a great example. We have this amazing guy who's worked for us for 5 years, and he came in as a prep guy. And then we're like, oh, you're going to do Bake Off and you're going to do this. And we just wanted to raise him up within the kitchen. And one
right.
day he was like, I just want to do prep.
Yep. Yep.
And we're like, okay. You know,
I actually
thank
have
you
someone
for actually vocalizing that who, you know,
he made it very clear. Yeah. He's like, I don't want to manage a team. I don't want to be responsible for whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go home at night
yep.
and I don't want to think about work.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's lovely,
right.
you know? So how'd you meet Agatha?
So yeah, moved to New York, recession. I applied, I think I counted at one point, I think I applied to 70 jobs between 2007 and 2010.
Right.
And the whole time I was still networking with people. I had another blog.
Right.
And a good friend of mine from college was in a book club that was focused on reading food books, articles, all this other
That's
stuff.
Cool.
And I joined it. And about 8 months in, or maybe a year in, Agatha came to a meeting that I went to. Because we, you know, not everyone went to every meeting.
Right.
But that whole time, her friend Kara, who ran it, who was my college friend's friend, was like, I think you should meet my friend Agatha. I think you guys would get along. And so we met in this book club, and I started a conversation with everyone being like, I'm really surprised a business hasn't come out of this book club because everyone's so interested in food. Everyone's so smart. And Agatha stuck around. It was at my house that day, and she was helping me clean up, and we were talking, and she was like, you know, I actually really want to start a business. We should sit down and have coffee and talk about it.
Oh.
And so a week later, we didn't know each other. You know, a week later, we sat down and we started planning a business together. I mean, it really was one of those moments of just completely trusting that the other person could be your business partner.
Yeah. We didn't, I mean, you didn't even know what skills she had or what.
We didn't know. And we also didn't have the quote unquote business skills to be like, let's sit down and interview each other to make sure we're good partners. Like, let's, what are your values?
Right.
You know, I think we were having a lot of conversations. And I think as women, we tend to have emotional conversations right off the outset.
Absolutely.
So we knew that we were aligned with one another. And we
knew friends with friends.
Friends with friends. Yeah. We knew we had the same ambitious goals.
What were, I mean, before we take the break, what was the vision? I mean,
the vision was to start a packaged gourmet bar snack company that we would then outsource all the snacks to. And then we would sell it for $1 billion in like 3 years.
Great.
It's a bakery. No.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, we're going to take a little break. And when we get back, we're going to hear how it went from an outsourced bar snack company to the amazing powerhouse it is today. In the Sauce is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan plant-based oat milk originally from Sweden that's now making their oat milk on this side of the Atlantic. I know you're used to hearing me talk about how important it is to have a killer product and a great brand identity, and Oatly has both. They're an oat milk company from the south of Sweden that's been around for 30 years making super sustainable oat milk. Actually, Oatly invented oat milk. Now they're in the US and people are loving it. If you haven't tried Oatly, I highly suggest it. It won't change your life, but it will certainly change your mornings. You can check it out at oatly.com. That's OATLY.com. I'm back with Erin Patinkin, co-founder and CEO of Ovenly. Okay, so you met Agatha in 2010, and you guys had this plan. How did you even...
Well, we met in 2009.
Oh, you met in 2009.
Yeah.
Okay. And then how long did it take, and did you actually come up with some snack products? And,
oh, yeah.
Okay, so tell me what happened.
Well, we... So the reason we decided on these snacks is because we didn't know... We knew we wanted to start a company. We just didn't know what. We knew it was going to be food. And we'd go to bars and we'd
By the way, that's not a bad idea.
You know what? I think if we started it now, it would be much better. I actually think we were a little bit ahead of our time with this idea at the time. We were ahead of the snack game. And people, I don't think, really understood it. But someone else go take that idea and make
it's yours. It's
not
yours.
Doing
go
it.
For it.
So we started with snacks. And we had two clients right off the bat. Once we finalized our, we just created two, and you know, the idea was we're going to add more and we would go and test things. And the first client was a Brooklyn brewery, which we got, I think, in like March or May of 2009, but we knew we weren't going to start working with them till I think August or September.
Right.
And then a bar that no longer exists called Veronica People's Club. And Veronica People's Club was launching in July, and the owner was an old friend of Agatha's, and she knew Agatha also loved to bake. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, listen, I'll sell your bar snacks, but I can't find good wholesale baked goods. And remember, this is 2010.
Yeah.
This was right at the start of this huge Brooklyn food movement, and there were no wholesale baked goods from artisan bakers. The options were Ceci Cela and Balthazar, and then whoever was selling the giant muffins to the bodegas.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah.
And so we were like, well, you know what? We're not doing anything else. We've been talking about this for so long.
Right.
It's not going to kill us to make baked goods. And we also had this person at the time who's also in the food industry. She gave a piece of advice to us that actually I think is one of the worst pieces of advice, which was never say no. Oh, you just got to say yes to everything.
Oh,
yeah. Bad piece of advice. So we were like, well, we have to say yes to everything, right, which we did for a long time. Yeah. And then at one point we're like, that was the worst advice ever. We should say no all the time and only say yes to the things we're good at.
Yeah.
So we said yes, and we started we would bake in our houses, and we would switch off, and we'd bring up baked goods 4 days a week. So I'd do Monday, Wednesday, she'd do Thursday, Friday, and we were making things that would have 2 day shelf life, so it'd last 7 days. And I would take the G train up to Greenpoint, drop them off. And that was in July, late June or early July 2010. And then by November, I had to quit my job.
And by 2015, you had 2 shops and 100 wholesale accounts.
Yeah, probably around that.
So it took you about 5 years to just, but you were cranking the whole way through.
The wholesale was the real focus for the first 2 years. We didn't have a store. Right. And so we did our first capital raise was to open that store. And we raised just enough money to open the store. We didn't raise enough money. You know, we were also lesson learned. We raised money literally to put it into drywall and equipment.
Yeah.
Not to hire staff, not to pay ourselves, nothing for operations. Yeah. Which I recommend to anyone looking to open a retail store out there or a restaurant, make sure that whatever you're raising also covers salaries, including your own. Even if it's a base salary, you need money to live.
It's actually the number one, you know, those statistics that are kind of skewed and sort of depressing, but somewhat true, that there's, you know, like 98% of businesses fail within their first whatever 2 years or... And the majority of those businesses, from what I understand, it's exactly that. They forgot that there's a year or two where they might not be profitable.
Well, and what I always tell people, you know, I ask a lot of young entrepreneurs, what is the number one reason companies go out of business? It's because they run out of cash.
Yeah.
It's not because people are tired. Yeah. It's not because people won't buy.
Right.
It's because you run out of cash. Yeah. You have to be able to support your salaries and your losses while you're growing. Otherwise, you close. If you have no money, you close down.
And it goes to, you know, I think it's one of the lessons I learned in brick and mortar that I hold fast to for CPG, because it gets even, you know, the bigger you are, and especially in CPG, when you're getting massive orders, you know, the lag between getting the order and getting paid
could be 45
massive.
Days, it, 60 days
It
sometimes.
Can be, yeah. And it's the reason why a bunch of really beloved brands that people really want don't make it, because they can't cover it because of the cash flow issues. Yep. Okay. So as you started growing, obviously you shifted out of bar snacks. You decided to do baked goods. I feel like we were an early...
Yeah, you were one of our first clients.
Yeah.
I mean, that was probably 2012.
It was 2012. It was January. And just a little factoid or trivia about Haven's Kitchen. I had no intention of using my kitchen for anything but cooking classes.
I remember that.
I put in the coffee machine because I figured people would come to class in the morning. I thought we'd have 3 classes a day. That was a little optimistic. that people would come in the morning, they'd want like a latte, and then they'd go into class or they'd go to the market with the teacher. And, you know, people were like, you should have some scones for them. And then maybe after class, they might want a cookie. So we hooked up with you guys and you delivered scones and cookies for us. And I had no...
And I literally delivered them.
Right. And you would hang them on the front door, which was so cute. And then we just, at some point, were like, maybe it seems like people want to come and actually sit. So that's when we put in some seating, and that's when we started doing our own baking, and then we added lunch, and then we added, you know, so, but yeah, we were, I like to, an early adopter.
Well,
but
I think that what you also are pointing out is that you can create a business, especially as a small business, if you aren't financing on one particular thing, you have to do what people want.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot be really precious about your ideas. Right. So in your case, you didn't say, no, I'm going to make the classes work. You were like, actually, people want to come here and eat. So I better have something to sell them.
100%. Well, that it goes back to what you were saying earlier, because I always think, I'm not a sailor, but I always think of it like sailing a boat a little bit. Because on one hand, like you were saying, everybody, you walk down the street and people are like, have you ever thought, I think you should open in Greenwich. You know, I'm like, that would not work well for us, but thank you for the advice. You know, everyone has an idea of what you should be doing. And so on one hand, you have to be very kind of like clear with what your vision is and like, you know, keep that sail tight or whatever, you know. But then you have to let it out sometimes, because sometimes every once in a while there's some pretty good feedback from the people that totally. Actually know and love yeah. your product. And that's where you get your best ideas.
Especially kind of. From your clients.
Especially from your clients.
I mean, the people who are buying your stuff are the ones who are telling you, if you did this, I would buy it.
Right.
You know, the guy who lives in Greenwich is like, who doesn't want to have to go to the West Village is right. the one who's like, come yeah. to Greenwich.
Also, I'm like, it's not a dense population yeah. in Greenwich, but thank you. Yeah. Okay. So getting now into like nitty gritty sort of business mm-hmm. stuff. Any kind of top things that come to mind that you wish you had put in place earlier as the two of you were building either the partnership or starting to hire or building mm-hmm. your plans, like stuff that you would like to save yourself if you could 5 years ago?
I mean, having more fun money.
More money.
That was I mean, I'm very open about this. People, I don't know why people are really hesitant to talk about money, but I find it very odd.
Yeah.
First year, we didn't take salary. Yeah. I made $1,100 a month assisting a friend. Well, by the way, I was working 14 hours a day baking, yeah. and I was also had a part-time job assisting a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And she basically gave me that job because she knew I needed to make some extra money. Right. It was kind of charity in a way. Yeah. But I made $1,300 a month the first year assisting my friend, and my rent was $1,100 a month.
Yeah.
So, and I don't come from money.
Yeah.
This was me cashing out my 401k. I mean, I was really, it was very stressful yeah. because...
Well, I'd like to dig into this a little mm-hmm. bit because, you know, I'm also pretty candid. Mm-hmm. I did have resources mm-hmm. behind me, and it's the only reason why any of mm-hmm. this worked.
Yeah.
Like, if it were...
And thank you for admitting that. Like, there are some people out yeah. there who, you know, you're like, how are you making this work no. for yourself? Just admit
it's
you
the have first resources thing I tell because people.
It alienates people who don't have resources 100%. To not... To think that, like, for some reason, this other person no. is just succeeding... By luck.
Yeah. I find it's so much of like, I think the same thing about the way that the media talks mm-hmm. about entrepreneurship. Overnight yeah. success. Really? That person was in it for 15 years before,
that.
Right?
I hate that
so much. No, I mean, and for the first yeah. couple of years, I didn't even want to speak, you know, when you're invited mm-hmm. to talk to entrepreneurs. I didn't honestly even think I should because I didn't have to raise money. Mm-hmm. I self-funded. It wasn't my, mm-hmm. you know, I have five kids. Obviously, I'm not supporting my five children on my cooking school income, right? Like, there's a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was embarrassed, A, because mm-hmm. it made me feel like I wasn't scrappy somehow, or mm-hmm. I didn't hustle the way everyone else did, so I didn't deserve to be up there. Mm-hmm. And B, it made me feel like I was giving them an unrealistic vision of what it could be. Of course you can build a 2 or 3 story building in Flatiron like that when, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do that mm-hmm. if I had to either, mm-hmm. you know, work for my friends or whatever.
But you still had to budget it out and
absolutely. And that's where
yeah,
I got to.
And ask for it. 100%. Figure it out. Yeah.
And work harder than, you know, anyone even knows that I work for mm-hmm. sure. Right. Mm-hmm. So I got over it. Yeah. But I do think that it's important. You know, we talk a lot on this podcast about like, what exactly does quote unquote bootstrapping mm-hmm. mean? And if you don't have a backup, you know, if this is your income, right. Or this is what you plan on doing for your life, you should plan on not making any money mm-hmm. for 3 to 5 years.
Yes,
I mean,
this is, I thank you for bringing that up yeah. because one of the things I think people don't realize is that if someone told me that, I didn't listen. I just don't remember anyone telling me that. And to be honest, the only advisors we would ask people for advice, and the only advisors we really had were people who already came from money
yeah.
or had access to capital through parents or friends, spouses.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a different type of stake absolutely. For Agatha and I, and I'm almost happy I didn't realize it because I don't know
you
that I would
have
started the company.
Yeah.
But when I am advising people who don't have that same access to means, I say, listen, you need to make sure you are raising money
yep.
to cover your salary, because the amount of stress that I lived under that first year
yep.
was really almost broke me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a really hard place. And to be totally honest, like I used all my meager savings from my arts and nonprofit career.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, didn't have health insurance for over a year. And then I also totally, I am a person who maxed out her credit cards and then ruined her credit for like 3 years because that was the only thing I needed to do to survive. Am I happy that I survived?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it
that's what the statistics are.
Right.
And you're one of the unusual ones. Mm. And it's not, and you know, no offense to you, but for other people out there, it's not because somehow you worked harder necessarily, or
I'll tell you why I'm one of the people who survived. It's because I quickly realized that I needed to raise money and also learn business.
Yeah.
So I think I'm a very quick study with business. So, you know, I'll tell you something that I did right off the bat that helped our cash flow. You know, I hear a lot of people be like, I can't collect my money from my clients.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know what? I got sick after 3 months of running the business of chasing people down for money. So from the first year, I said, if you want to be my client, you have to put a credit card or a bank account on file with us. And we'll either pull that money or we'll charge it. And if you don't give us the money, we will stop delivering to you. I cannot tell you how many people tell me, they're like, well, this client's so big, I can't get rid of them. I'm like, if they don't pay you, you're not making money. I don't care if it's the biggest company in the world. They're using you as a bank and you're a single person who's a small business. You should sue them.
It's why, like, we never sold to Dean and DeLuca.
Oh.
Because we heard very early on they didn't pay their vendors. But they did
they were bought out. Right. And then they stopped.
It's a really good account. And, you know, it's really good for marketing. And I'm like, I'm not doing it for marketing, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think like any business, you have to decide, like, okay, what is the goal here?
And also, you can only absorb a marketing expense like that if you have money.
Right.
Because most small companies I know have a cash flow problem.
Right. Totally. So let's go to that for a second, because it seems to me like right now there is a lot of money around. I don't know how much longer that's going to last. Mm-hmm. I don't know if these kind of a great brand and a good idea are going to get funded seemingly as quickly as they are in this climate. But it seems to me like there are a lot of people that don't want to. It seems to me like if you can't sort of self-fund it for at least a year or two and get it going and see if it's got legs, then you should raise money pre-revenue. I think a lot of people are nervous about doing that, A, because they haven't raised money before, or B, they've heard somewhere that they're not supposed to give equity away. I think you and I both agree that like 100% of a dollar is not great compared to 20% of a couple million dollars, right? So I think, you know, one of the first things that I sort of advise, and I wonder if you do the same with people that have ideas that come to you, is like, have a very serious sit down with yourself, and if you have a partner, about the money before anything else, because people get very excited about the ideas and there's all of these incredible people around you that are eager to design your idea and help you, you know, social media-ize your idea. But no one is really digging into how expensive this is. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I tell people, well, even before we get into the money, I'm making all this stuff just on my website, by the way. Yeah. I get asked so many questions all the time that I started just making resources because I found that I didn't have time to sit down
make their deck.
I've created all these decks. I've created all these pro formas, and I'm just, I have to clean them up and then I put them on my website, which is just aaronpatinkin.com. But one of the things that I do is I've created a Google survey that I send to people. And it's asked questions like, what will happen if you run out of money?
Yeah.
Does it ruin you financially?
Right.
Or not? Why you? Can you, you know, I ask all these questions. I don't look at the answers. The answers are just shared with that person.
Right.
And it, but it helps kind of think about, well, here are the real stakes here.
Yeah.
Can you handle that?
Yep.
And if you can, then start your business.
Right.
Like, I think people ponder and plan for far too long. And even the ones with good ideas, where a lot of people just don't take things off the ground because they sit there and think about them for too long. Like, you need to decide at some point you're either comfortable starting a business or not. So that's step one. Right. Even before you start the business and raise money, decide if you're comfortable starting the business and what those things mean. So that's usually where I start.
Yeah.
And then when it does come down to brass tacks and money, I tell people to make a pro forma. It's so unbelievably shocking to me.
Yeah.
When I talk to people and they say, well, I'm not really good with money, so I'm just going to have someone else do it. You cannot have someone else do it.
No.
You have to do it.
Yeah.
I don't care if someone is sitting there helping you enter data or creating that pro forma for you. If you do not know your numbers and you are the leader of the company, or if your partner doesn't know those numbers, you know, there are I'm in business partnerships where I am the person who understands money. That's fine. But someone at the top has got to be the person who understands the money. And partners who understand money should be trying to educate their partners as much as they can about how the company works financially, because it will, in the end, prevent people from overspending or going over budget.
Yeah,
that's something that we try to do at Ovenly with our managers. We are open book. You know, I advise people and, you know, people who have a hard time understanding numbers, I will sit down line by line and explain as best I can.
Yeah.
I tell people to take accounting.
Yeah.
If you want to do yourself a favor, take an accounting class.
Well, that's especially
very valuable.
In CPG too, you know, I mean, I had a lot to learn about margins, right? Because, you know, I mean, the margins are thin in all of our businesses.
Business of pennies.
But at the end of the day, it comes down to pennies. So if your tolling is, you know, 81 cents, but you could be paying, you know, 78 cents per box. That's massive.
Huge.
You know, and I don't know that people really understand that until, you know, until they've learned it either the hard way. Or, you know, I think, I mean, I tend to sort of, I don't know, relate better to creative people or food people who then have made products, as opposed to finance people who have identified a white space and then they're really good at that. So I tend to speak more to that first group. You know, that second group, they have other things that they've got this part pretty probably. So when we don't have that much time, so I want to get to other stuff. So
really quickly, know your numbers. And then if you know your numbers, then you can talk to investors. Done. That's the thing. Investors, they're going to love, investors don't love ideas. They love their potential for return on their investment.
Right.
So you can have the best idea in the world, but if you can't show investors how they're going to make their money back and then some, that's better than market rate. Even if you're a triple bottom line company, you're not going to get invested in.
Right.
So you got to get, you got to know your numbers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people make the mistake of thinking that somehow they're going to get money from a bank.
Yeah,
and you're not going to get money from a bank.
Not to start. Maybe five or 10 years in.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. So when you did that round of investment, I mean, because you've done more than one now, right?
At Ovenly, we've done, we did a small seed investment with a friend who almost immediately got bought out. And then we did a friends and family raise that was not enough money. Then we did a real seed round far too late in the life cycle of the business. We should have done it far earlier.
And that was 2015.
That was in 2015. And then we did raise money from a lender who is a vision and value aligned company organization that only funds companies that create good jobs. So we've done sort of three rounds. And so, friends, family, seed, institutional debt.
And aside from, doing it earlier, what would be sort of, top two or three sort of words of wisdom that you've learned from that?
I mean, something that you mentioned earlier, know your margins.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid to raise prices if you're not making money, because the truth of the matter is if you can't make money within your business model, then the business is not viable.
Right.
So even if you're going to lose money in that first 3 to 5 years, plan it.
Right.
And just show that you have a pathway to making money. I think that that's really important. And raise enough money. I mean, earlier or not earlier, even in that secondary round of investment, we probably should have raised twice what we raised.
Right.
And that's something kind of I learned the hard way, where it's like, you may think you only need X, raise 25% more than you think.
Yeah.
30% more than you think.
Yeah.
So I think those are two big things that I didn't know.
Awesome. Okay. We have, I mean, I wanted to talk about your hiring practices, which are amazing. I wanted to talk about a bunch of other things, but I also do
want to go at oven.ly and check out, we share all that information. Yeah.
It's very cool, guys. Like, go on oven.ly because they have these, just these incredible practices where they don't do traditional interviewing and candidates come in and they just start with a trial and you have all these amazing statistics about, you know, hiring formerly incarcerated and political refugees and, you know, at-risk communities. And mm-hmm. It's just awesome.
Thank you.
So I would like to do that, but I want to talk about Seymour.
Okay, good. Let's talk about it.
Tell me about Seymour.
Okay. So as I have progressed through my career, I've realized that access to capital and having these conversations, and that's where you and I are like the same person, are so important. Because what I realized being a woman, and it started with my own personal experience, obviously, was that I was not being led into conversations, and it started feeling a little bit purposeful.
Yeah.
And also I was being treated by certain people in a way that, I give this example all the time, but I had, a potential investor wrote Agatha an email telling her that he didn't believe that my email that I had sent him was written by me because it was too smart. And he wanted to know what man had written my email.
Wait.
And so there's so many layers. First of all, he couldn't even email me and say, who wrote this email for you? He had to email my business partner.
Oh my gosh.
So
wait, what year was that?
2015.
Holy mackerel.
So, you know, there are things like that when they're, and I honestly think this person thought it was a normal thing to do.
Right.
Yeah. And so that process in 2015, it was just very eye-opening. We had, and you know what? I'll be honest. We met with a group of women who treated us like we were 19 when we were 35.
I had a few really unsavory female experiences.
And so I really was feeling, I'm a liberal. I hate Trump. And then Trump won and the Weinstein stuff happened. And I was starting to have like severe anxiety. Yeah. And I had this moment of really realizing some of the ways I had been socialized. I started feeling angry.
Yep.
And I was like, you know what? This is not healthy for me. And so what can I do? And the big thing for me I started thinking about in 2016 was, what can I do to promote overlooked entrepreneurs?
Yep.
And so I started just advising a bunch of people. I started my own podcast called Start to Sale because I wanted to have conversations that people don't have, because most podcast hosts who host about business, except honestly for the Heritage Network, are journalists interviewing business people and they're not having these
open conversations. Or venture fund people or
tech people. That's a very different industry.
Yep.
And so in 2017, I started making a plan to think about how I could really hands-on help people. And then 2018, last year, and you know, I kind of started putting out in the world that I wanted to help people launch businesses. Mm-hmm. And so last February of 2018, a mutual friend of Cara Nicoletti and mine named Marion Bull introduced us, and Cara was interested in starting a business. And Cara is a fourth-generation butcher. She's worked a bunch of different places and she has a huge following. She won Chopped, and she started creating these sort of, mixed, I can't reveal too much cause we're not launched, but these really interesting sausage flavors.
Uh-huh.
And so I love the idea so much that last year I created the business plan for it. You know, her idea was like, I'm going to create a butcher shop.
Right.
And we went through this whole process. What do you want out of life?
Right.
I mean, that's one of the big questions. Where do you want to end up?
Yep.
And so that was my big question for her. I was like, do you want to be a butcher behind a butcher counter? Because if you do, start a butcher shop.
Yep.
That's a great idea. But if you don't, then you need to think about a different way to make money with your amazing product. And so that's how we started getting involved with each other. We're launching in November, but I basically helped Cara from the moment she decided to... She agreed with the business plan that I came out with, which is a CPG play, triple bottom line, first public benefits LLC in the meat industry, probably. Public benefits LLC is a mandated triple bottom line.
Right.
It's only in the
state of Delaware. So triple is environment or social
and
capital.
Yeah. And then, you know, helped her put together a fundraising plan, held her hand through fundraising meetings.
Very cool.
I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do was be the director,
right.
her director.
Yeah.
And so we would go into fundraising meetings.
Which goes back to your training.
Yep. No, seriously. It's like, it's directing is what made me be able to do this. We'd sit in fundraising meetings. She would do her pitch. She'd talk to investors. We'd leave. And I'd have a page of notes.
Yeah.
Because no one did that for
me.
So
I did.
I had to learn.
Dreamy.
I had to learn how to speak to investors by myself because no one told me. And I happened to be a quick
startup.
So
when we sell our businesses for a lot of money and we have our own capital to invest, we're just going to do that.
That's what I want to do. Yeah. I mean, this
is what I want to do too.
This is how I spend, like, you know, I work full time at Ovenly and then I spend my evenings helping people do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a couple people that I'm working on their projects with now.
Very cool.
And I fall into that in different ways. Like with Cara, full on co-founder, help you launch. With some other people, I'm filling in that section of, let me teach you how to speak to investors. So that's really my goal. I want to help overlooked entrepreneurs with scalable ideas launch their companies.
Very cool. I mean, it's kind of what I want to do too, except you're actually doing it, which makes me feel a little bit like kind of bad about myself. But well, thank you for coming, Erin.
Don't
was
feel
great
bad. Everyone can participate in this if you know things. We can do it together.
I'm all happy to help anybody. Okay. Anyway, last second. Best moment. Can you think of one? I'm sure there have been many.
Yes, I can. I think it was like in year six or seven. I mean, it's not that long ago. Maybe it's like year six. I went to work one day and I said, you know, Agatha, I don't think we're going out of business. And she was like, I don't think we are either.
Wow.
And it was that day. It was probably year five or six where I was like, oh, we created a thing.
That's a thing.
And unless we really fuck up,
it's
going to last.
Ah.
That was
I
a
just
really
got chills
good moment.
Again. Erin, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
This was like beyond inspiring. We have so much more to talk about, but Matt's being kind of a jerk in the box over there and making faces at me. But we're happy that you're back, Matt, and we missed you. He's like, I was only gone for 1 week, but it felt like a really long time for us. Anyway, best engineer ever. And we have, I think, like 10 or 11 new episodes coming up in the fall season.
Listen to all of them, everyone.
Yes. Lots of fun guests from all different sort of perspectives on the industry. And thank you for listening.
Thank you, guys.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.